Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Hi, it's Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for listening to On Point. If you love this show, you may also love other great podcasts, shows, and journalism brought to you by NPR. When you support your local public radio station, it helps us keep our show going and helps NPR create new ones. The best way to keep On Point and NPR strong is to donate to your station. Visit donate.npr.org/onpoint to give. Then share why you did using the hashtag WhyPublicRadio. And thanks. From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We have watched for years now the African exodus into the Mediterranean. Desperate refugees and migrants trying to reach Europe. Terrible scenes and stories and often fates. And still, the footage of some of those migrants in Libya being auctioned into apparent slavery is shocking. We want to know that story. The CNN team that brought it out is with us. This hour on Point, slaves on the auction block in North Africa in 2017. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did you see CNN's undercover footage that's gone viral? Have you seen the protests in Europe as people wake up to an ancient nightmare unfolding again right now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's the tape that got CNN's attention. Original tape of an auction in Libya that was smuggled to CNN. It led to my guest today's special report. The narrator you hear is our guest, Nema El-Baghir. And the man being sold here is Nigerian.
A man addressing an unseen crowd. Big strong boys for farm work, he says. 400. 700. 700. 800. The numbers roll in. These men are sold for 1,200 Libyan pounds, $400 apiece.
That was the tape that got their attention. They'd been following this story. They knew it well, but not this particular face of it. And in they went. Nema El-Baghir and Raja Razek, who will both join us in just a moment. Here they are from their report, People for Sale. Here's Nema describing their drive to a slave auction and their preparations to go in and secretly record it.
For the safety of our contacts, we have agreed not to divulge the location of this auction. But the town we're driving to isn't the only one. Night falls. We travel through nondescript suburban neighborhoods, pretending to look for a missing person. Eventually, we stop outside a house like any other. Adjust our secret cameras. And wait. Finally, it's time to move.
Inside, in the dark, they found the auctions going on in the dead of night. Here it was.
We're ushered into one of two auctions happening on this same night. Crouched at the back of the yard, a floodlight obscuring much of the scene. One by one, men are brought out as the bidding begins. 400. 500. 550. 600. 650. 700. Very quickly, it's over.
The CNN crew has witnessed the auction. Here's Nema. She and Raja and the crew, they moved away from the house. She stood before the camera and did her stand-up, absorbing what she had just seen.
That was over very quickly. We walked in, and as soon as we walked in, the men started covering their faces, but they clearly wanted to finish what they were doing, and they kept bringing out what they kept referring to in Arabic as al-budaa, the merchandise. All in all, they admitted to us that there were 12 Nigerians that were sold in front of us. And I honestly don't know what to say. That was probably one of the most unbelievable things I've ever seen.
In the days since, protests all over the place. Here are protesters chanting anti-slavery slavery slogans outside the Libyan embassy in London on Sunday.
We condemn slavery. We condemn slavery. We are not for sale.
We are not for sale.
Well, but some are. Joining me now from London are the two CNN journalists who have covered the refugee stories out of the Middle East and Africa for years and who found out about this particular slave trade and went undercover to unmask it. Nema El-Baghir, a senior international correspondent for CNN, is with us. Nema, it's so good of you to join us. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you so much for having us on, Tom.
And sitting beside her in London is Raja Razek, award-winning producer for CNN. Raja, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Tom.
Raja, Nema, and their colleagues produced the CNN special report titled People for Sale. It first aired a couple of weeks ago. It has gone viral. You can watch that report yourself at our website, onpointradio.org. Nema, first to you, where did you get this first tape that clued you in to what was going on here?
Well, this was part of a broader investigation that we were doing into, you know, for about a year, there was this real sense of urgency around these people dying to get to Europe. And then suddenly it felt like it had been pushed out of public consciousness. And we were trying to figure out, so what happened? Did people stop coming or did they just stop arriving on European shores? Mm-hmm. And that was kind of what set us on the journey. And then we suddenly realized they just stopped arriving. It was almost like Europe had successfully pushed it behind the veil. And we slowly began uncovering what was happening to them there. And it was a contact of ours that we'd worked with, well, Raja had worked with, on a few stories during the Syrian migrant crisis. And we asked him to go and see if there was any way that he could help us verify this. And I think it really gives you a sense of the brazenness that when he went along successfully to the first auction that he managed to access, they asked him, well, are you here buying for yourself or are you buying for someone else? And before he could answer, they said, well, if you're buying for someone else, then you might as well show them what we have. It was like,
because he had his iPad right out there recording what was going on.
Yeah, there was no undercoverness about what he was doing. A friend said to me that in the most horrifying way, it was like when you're in a shop and you're almost in two minds about what you're buying and you kind of whip out your phone and you snap a picture and send it to someone back home and say, hey, what do you think? I mean, that was throughout this. It was this, just the utter banality of the evil was really what kept kind of hitting home to both of us. Right, Raja?
Yeah, correct.
Raja, how did you figure out then where to go on the night when you actually got the footage yourself of these auctions going on?
Well, I mean, this was like Nema was saying, it took a lot of planning. So it's not like we just figured out, you know, a few days before that. We had already started a plan, and then we got there and we waited. And we were told that auctions usually go on mostly at the end of the month because what they called, like Nema said, merchandise or new shipment comes in, which means the new migrants start to come in. And so when the warehouses where they keep these migrants before they decide it's time to put them on a boat to go to Europe, if the warehouse overflows, they want to get rid of some of them. And this is how the auction concept started, which is they'll go out and they'll sell some of them for money, telling these migrants that it's money that's going to help get them to Europe. But they don't get the money.
When they're sold, what is the deal exactly? Is this like day labor? I mean, here in the United States, you can find people, you know, in Home Depot parking lots ready to work for a day. I mean, it may not be pretty, but it happens. Or are they literally sold into what would fairly be called slavery?
Yeah, I mean, that was the question that we really had to interrogate because we almost didn't believe it ourselves. You know, you kind of in your head, you think, well, is this modern slavery? Is this debt bondage? But actually, no, legally, it is slavery because they have no agency over what they are sent off to do. They are held captive in these warehouses. They don't receive any of the remuneration. And even though initially, and I know a lot of people were quite jarred by the fact that in that initial footage, one of the men being sold off was actually smiling. And that's because what the what he was being told is, you know, you're going to pay this off in Arabic. He was told in the video, you're going to pay this off, and inshallah, mm-hmm. God willing, we'll get you to Europe. So initially they're told, you owe us a debt. Because less boats are arriving in Europe, the price has gone up. So you now owe us money. But we're going to sell you, you're going to work, you're going to pay off that money, and eventually you're going to go to Europe. But what happens is they are sold again and again, and that imagined debt is never paid off. And often, even after they have been sold again and again, even that isn't enough. We found a number of people who were then ransomed off. Their families were contacted because they had gotten too weak to work, or there was no market for them at that point. So they were still trying to squeeze money out of them even at that point. And the young man who we interviewed in our piece, his family had to ransom $3,000 before he was eventually allowed to just sit in the warehouse.
Here's a little bit from that young man. It goes by the name Victory, in one of these so-called warehouses or detention centers in Libya, talking with the CNN crew, other refugees around him. He's describing the ordeal these people go through before they end up in a detention center. Beating, slavery, death.
You look at most of the people here, if you check their body, you see the mark, they're beaten with electric, even your buto, they took something like a sharp object. Understand? Most of them lost their life there. Men are dying every day.
Men are dying every day. If you look at most people here, if you check their bodies, you will see they are beaten with electric cable. I mean, Nema, are you saying that this is being kind of bottled up, that it's effectively some of this cross-Mediterranean traffic has been bottled up, and so as it overflows, they're sold?
Yeah. They are essentially, I shouldn't say essentially, they are a commodity as far as these people are concerned. So as that bottleneck has increased the pressure on the resources of the traffickers, they have found other ways to make money off these human beings. And this is really the conversation that we have attempted to have with European officials. What is the moral culpability when you know that by putting the responsibility on the Libyan authorities, as it is, I mean, you have competing governments, you have militias, as it is, you have made this their responsibility. What is your moral culpability in this?
And their response?
Well, at the moment, given the public uproar, they're trying very quickly to think of a good one.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about slaves on the auction block in North Africa in 2017 with the CNN team that was there, that saw it, recorded it in Libya. Refugees, migrants now sold at auction in our time. Here's another moment from the work of Nema El-Bagir and Raja Razek, undercover in Libya. It's at our website. You can see it there, onpointradio.org. A buyer could be a builder, could be a farmer, apparently didn't like the slaves on offer. One of the men from Niger. Niger.
These men are sold for 1,200 Libyan pounds, $400 a piece. You are watching an auction of human beings. Another man, claiming to be a buyer, off camera, someone asks, what happened to the ones from Niger? Sold off, he's told.
The response in Europe has been electric. Here was the sound from an anti-slavery protest outside the Libyan embassy in Paris. They're chanting in French, free our brothers. Of course, they're on the front lines there. And here, another protester outside of London's Libyan embassy just this last Sunday.
Have you learned nothing from history? Have you learned nothing from our story? For you to continue to do business with those who enslaved us and continue to profit from us. Shame on you!
It is, of course, part of a big picture, and we will look at all of it. Nema El-Bagir and Raja Razek are with us in London. Tom's calling from Manchester, Connecticut. Tom, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes. I'm still appalled to hear that this is going on. I'm an African-American gentleman, college-educated, early 60s, second-wave baby boomer, and when I think about maybe in descendants of slaves in the past, like from 1865 to the 13th Amendment, you thought it ended slavery, but it didn't, because it still went on as white slavery. And then today, there's always exploitation of you know, human beings, I guess, for profit, or treating them as property, and it's wrong. And I'm hoping that our UN representative, Nikki Haley, would speak out about it, and under the Trump administration too, since they're for human rights for certain countries, and I don't know, they, you know, I guess there's a dual purpose there with, you know, against other countries, because it's wrong, period, no matter what group it happens to, or gender or sexual orientation. No one should be property of somebody else or be treated like a subhuman or...
Tom, let me ask you, what do you think of the circumstances in which this is happening? I mean, you've got something like 700,000 migrants in Libya, and these smugglers, they've made their way up from all over Africa, many from Nigeria, but from all over the place, and Syria as well. Our guest, Raja Razak, went undercover herself, posing as a Syrian refugee. But all these Africans coming... And, you know, Europe has sometimes taken them, sometimes not taken them, sometimes rescued the boat, sometimes the boats just go down in the Mediterranean. Now they've kind of got it bottled up, and so they're selling them up. What do you do with this situation, Tom?
Well, something needs to be done, both, you know, in an international way, no matter, you know, Europe, Asia, to come to The Hague and do something about it, for laws against them, and using Interpol, international police, to track down these enslavers, whoever the big ones are, and put them under arrest. I mean, I guess it's going to be some danger involved with it, but this, you know, can't go on, because I know some, like I said, have died under captivity or been mistreated and beaten, and it's just not right. I mean, we should be all appalled at it, and even having the, you know, national and international media in on that too, for certain stories, not just for, you know, 1 month, but this is really sad, especially with Human Rights Day coming up next month, the 69th anniversary, I believe.
We're well into it. We'll look at the legal angle here and how that may work, but there's just a human flow as well, and that has really tied people in knots. Samuel in Natick, Massachusetts. Samuel, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Hi.
I have a question. It is a very simple question. This question is directed to my own government here in the United States and the government of Great Britain and the press. If it was not, you know, CNN that decided, to do the writing, would we be talking about this today? That's question number one. Question number two, if this were white, you know, men, you know, and women being sold, humiliated, you know, like that. How will the world be today? This would have come out all along. As someone who came from Africa, came here, went through, pharmacy school, school of medicine, school of public health, school of management. You know what? I still see it today that, once you are black, forget it. You have a different standard. You have a different, everything else is, the deck is stacked against you.
But what should they do, Samuel? So they just open up the doors and say, everybody come on into Europe, and that way they're not trapped in these camps?
Not. Absolutely not. Don't forget that when in Libya, here in the United States, Libya is one of the, number one people that sends their kids here to go to school, and they pay for it. Fine. When the Libyan, debacle, started, bombarded, just destroyed, decapitated Gaddafi, right?
Gaddafi,
saw it in television. African countries were not notified. Did they tell any person? No, they just went and destroyed it. Okay, look at the unintended consequences, all the intended consequences.
Samuel, we've got it. I mean, your basic point, if it were white people being sold and humiliated, something would be done. When you hear that, Nema, is there, what's the lever to pull here? Is it clear?
Well, I completely understand the strength of Samuel's feeling, but I think, first of all, we all saw what happened to the Syrians during the refugee crisis. It took a toddler drowning on a Turkish shore for the world to wake up on that, and many of them were blonde and blue-eyed, even if they were Arab. So I'm not sure necessarily that that's what this is about. What this is about is, this is a deeply unpopular issue, immigration, at a time when you have the rise of far-right parties off the back of someone like Angela Merkel in Germany allowing Syrian refugees to be given asylum in Germany. So, But I think I do agree with Samuel in that this wasn't an unknown story. The International Organization of Migration has been speaking out about this for months now, and slowly migrants have been giving their testimony. It is really down to the listeners, it's down to the people who shared this, it's down to the audience that now the international community, the French president, the UN, that they now care, because there has been such outrage. But they knew about this all along.
I mean, you've got tape here, you and Raja, from a guy who's working in one of these detention centers, government-run detention centers, packed with migrants after failed journeys to Europe. And you're talking with one of them, Anas Alzabi, a supervisor there, who says he's suffering for their circumstances, but slavery? Just rumors, he says.
I'm suffering for them. I am suffering for them. What I have seen here daily, believe me, make me really feel pain for them. They was abusing them, fused, they stole their money.
Have you heard about people being auctioned off, about migrants being sold?
Honestly, we hear the rumors, but there is nothing is obvious in front of us. We don't have evidence.
We don't have the evidence. Greg in Buffalo, New York. Greg, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, who's doing the buying and selling? Does this break down along some ethnic lines?
Raja, what do you say?
Okay, who's doing the selling? The Libyans are the ones that are selling, and Libyans are the ones who are buying.
And is it, I mean, we heard about big, strong boys for farming. Is it farmers? Is it people who need day labor? What happens to these people? Do they stay in Libya? Do they get shipped off?
It's everything. What the situation was after the fall of Gaddafi is Libya was obviously incredibly wealthy. It was a country that was very reliant on foreign migrant labor. All of that stopped as the insecurity grew. And so now these slaves, these people who have been enslaved, are filling that gap. So, yes, it is Libyans. And it does, unfortunately, fall along ethnic lines, because even though Libyans do have darker skinned Libyans of Arab descent, of African descent, sorry, a lot of those that we saw in the auctions were of Arab descent selling African migrants. And it plays into a deep cultural residual racism.
Nema, is Libya accepting that this is going on? I mean, over the weekend, you know, we had Donald Trump tweeting over the weekend, CNN International, that's who you guys work for, as he said, is a major source of fake news. And then we have had Libyan media picking up on the U.S. president and casting doubt on your report. I guess is Libya acknowledging this is happening?
Well, I think there is a real cognitive dissonance. I think it's very difficult for anyone to really look into that darkest part of their soul. There's a lot of public embarrassment, but at the same time, they have had to acknowledge publicly that the evidence is compelling, and that they are opening a formal investigation. It makes our job difficult. I know a lot of our colleagues in other organizations have very generously stood up and said CNN International does great work. But the reality is that this isn't just about endangering journalists around the world or endangering our colleagues on CNN International. What it does is it give opportunity to those who would seek to not act upon the findings of journalists. And I think that that's the saddest part of all of this for me. When Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador to the US herself, acknowledges that this is horrifying, it's difficult when the president then gives those who would seek to not bear responsibility a way out.
Nema and Raja talked to a young Nigerian. Again, this young guy, Victory, he was in a detention camp, described how smugglers sold him. Here he was.
I was sold. On my way coming, I was sold. So after I was sold, they asked me to demand a ransom. The pusherman that put me from Nigeria, I gave him money, did not pay. So they said, since he's not paid, he did not pay that money. They not sold me.
They demanded ransom, gave him money, but he didn't pay up. They sold me. Nema Elbagir, Raja, please stand by there in London. I want to bring in Ben Taub in New York. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. He has been all over the place, like you two. He was supported by the Pulitzer Center on crisis reporting, looking extensively at refugees and human trafficking from Africa to Europe. Big stories on this. You can link to them at our website, onpointradio.org. Ben Taub, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Like Raja and Nema, you have looked a lot at this. Were you surprised by what they found in their footage, or has this been going on under everybody's noses for a while?
It's been going on for a very long time. What Raja and Nema found is extraordinary because there hasn't been footage, as far as I've seen, mm-hmm. that's come forward to prove it. Everyone sort of knew this was happening beneath the surface. You know, thousands of migrants have given testimony to this effect. But it hasn't really taken hold in the public eye. But it's so widely known among officials and you know, human rights organizations and journalists that I find it completely disingenuous when EU or African officials are feigning surprise and claiming this is something they didn't know about, because in fact it is in many ways the policies of the European Union that are fueling this activity, as the CNN report found.
Ben, where are we in the arc of those policies? Europe has struggled with the Syrian refugee crisis, with this migrant refugee flow from Africa, in the African flow in particular. And we've all seen the terrible images of the super overcrowded boats going down at sea and all the rest. Where does European policy stand now on how they're dealing with that refugee flow, either, you know, integrating or blocking or turning back? Where are we in the arc of this story on policy terms, Ben?
So essentially, there's been mutations of the same policy for the past 15 years or so, where the EU has essentially paid off coastal African nations to try to police migration on their behalf. And that functioned until, in certain ways, that was effective until the Libyan coastline completely broke down. It's 1,000 miles of open coastline facing southern Italy and Greece. And when there's no government, there is no government to pay off, essentially. So the Gaddafi was exploiting this as well. He was trying to extort the EU, demanding 5 billion euros a year at a certain time in order to police this. And in fact, when the NATO bombing campaign began in Libya, his troops, in order to try to sort of threaten Europe and make them understand the stakes of its collapse, they were rounding up migrant workers working in Libya, sub-Saharan black Africans, who had no intention of going to Europe and were just making money in Libya, rounded them up, packed them onto ships and sent them in the direction of Europe at gunpoint. And the European policy really changed in after a shipwreck on October 3rd, 2013. This was the first time, you know, there'd been many shipwrecks, but it wasn't really in the face of the public. In the same way that Nima and Raja's report brought this to the face of the public, what happened on October 3rd was that a boat filled with hundreds of people sunk less than a quarter mile from Lampedusa, a southern Italian island. Mm-hmm. And so for the first time, the Italian public was watching as these bodies were being pulled out of the sea for the next week. And so at that point, there was uproar across Europe, and European officials called for and funded a campaign to carry out search and rescue operations. But this had an unintended effect. Whereas before, the smugglers would pack people into wooden fishing boats, hundreds of people. It was incredibly dangerous conditions, but these were boats that were designed to travel in the Mediterranean Sea. Mm-hmm. Once the search and rescue operations began, the smugglers figured, oh, well, we don't actually have to get them to Lampedusa.
Oh, wow.
We just have to get them to international waters. Mm-hmm. And so they started packing people into unseaworthy vessels, these inflatable dinghies, which would leave with only enough fuel to reach international waters, where they would immediately sink, 20 miles off the coast of Tripoli. So there was... It created this pull effect, which of course now the European Union is sort of blaming on the NGOs. But what really happened was, at a certain point, once the Europeans learned that their policy had created this pull that was making things more dangerous, they started pulling back, and NGOs had to fill in the void of carrying out these search and rescue operations.
But where does it stand now? Are they just sinking? Are they not going to sea? Why are they stacking up in such numbers inside Libya and then, as Raja and Nema report, being sold off?
Right. So the strategy that sort of followed this realization on the part of the European Union was, let's train and equip Libya's Coast Guard. Now, that's the same thing they'd been pursuing for more than a decade, but there really wasn't such a thing as a Libyan Coast Guard anymore. There is not one Libyan government. So who do you negotiate with? Who do you sort of sort this out with? And really, it essentially comes down to whichever warlord or faction manages to present himself or itself as being somehow legitimate, having, you know, having meetings in which they'll be willing to discuss humane conditions and so forth. But really, what they're doing now is they're paying off what has been created as a Libyan Coast Guard, and is really just a group of militias that are sending migrants back before they can reach international waters, and then leading them to these conditions where they're being detained and sold and trafficked on the continent.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about slaves on the auction block in North Africa in 2017 with the CNN team that was there, saw it in Libya. Refugees, migrants now sold at auction in our time. Nema El-Bagher and Raja Razek went in undercover, brought out footage that has really got the attention of the world here. It did not start yesterday, but it is happening right under the eyes of the world right now, the nose of the world right now. They're with us from London and CNN. Ben Taub is here from The New Yorker. He's been covering all this himself, like Nema and Raja, for years as Africa and Europe, Syria and beyond, have wrestled with this refugee migrant flow. You can join us this hour. What is the answer to the flow of desperate migrants made vulnerable to utter dehumanization here? These migrants have been ignored different times, rescued, let die, sent back. What now? What should the world do? Ben talked with a 22-year-old Nigerian barber named John, who described the many ways that smugglers find to monetize the human beings trying to flee to Europe. It's not just in Libya. Let's listen.
What they do is, you know, beat you up, torture you so that you can call your family to send money, form of kidnapping.
So it's the same as they do in Libya?
Yes, yes, same. Same. They stab many people. To stab many just to get what they want.
Beat you, torture you, stab you, or in the case of what CNN witnessed, just sell you. On Wednesday, on the sidelines of the African Union-European Union summit in Ivory Coast, French President Emmanuel Macron told France 24 that he would be proposing military action against human traffickers to combat migrant slave trading.
But we have to take police action against the human traffickers network. So there will be sanctions as part of the UN against human traffickers. We have started identifying them. Now we have to have individual financial sanctions, but also physical sanctions and act them. And of course, they have to be tried. They have to be taken to court, and we have to see whether that is enough.
The French president talking about that path, Nema, Raja putting themselves at risk to bring out this story. Ben Taub, who's been in the thick of it as well. Karen in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Karen, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I don't see how this is much different than conditions that I saw with migrant workers in North Carolina, where they would be kept in these camps. These workers that I was working with, there were five in their family, and they all had to sleep in one full bed, and they would work in these camps. There were no toilet facilities, no water, and the grower would pay the contractor, and the contractor then would give food and stuff to the migrant workers, and if the crops weren't ready yet, then he would take out an exorbitant amount. Like for beans and rice, he would charge him, you know, like $15 for a meal.
Yep.
And he would deduct all these from their payment. And if somebody got sick, I talked to somebody who was turned away at gunpoint, who worked for a health facility.
Karen, we've got the idea in your question, and I'll take it to everybody here, but Ben, what about it? I mean, migrant workers all over the world can find pretty tough circumstances. And Karen said, from Oklahoma, says, what's the difference here?
Certainly. Migrant workers all over the world are being exploited in all kinds of ways. But there is a certain level of cruelty in Libya and a level of exploitation that is not really being matched in most parts of the world. As a short summary of one example, there was a a facility in southern Libya in a near a town called Sabah, where most people get to when they come from West Africa as soon as they cross the desert. Mm-hmm. And in this particular facility, which was corroborated by several accounts, and they were every week they would take out five people and murder them so that the other captives, first of all, this would make space for more captives, mm-hmm. but it would also make sure that the others understood the stakes of their families not paying their ransoms so that on their phone calls they would be more effective in pleading for money. And this was corroborated by an embassy cable sent from the German embassy in Niger to Berlin, corroborating these weekly executions and comparing the conditions in Libya's migrant connection houses to those of Nazi concentration camps, where sometimes the sick would be buried alive. So I think there's a level of there is no rule of law in Libya, and so there's a level of cruelty that is, you know, amplified by these conditions.
We have to think about levels of cruelty here. It's pretty wild. I mean, from West Africa, these are people coming across sometimes 1,000 miles of desert in open trucks and into these camps. I mean, we've got a little clip that Ben sent us interviewing a man called, you're calling IK, telling you how he got roped into this bondage, debt bondage, you know, it's their terms, and ultimately a kind of slavery. Let's listen.
After that, they say, I have to pay my transport. I say, I've already paid everything.
To whom?
To the transport,
to the connection
drivers, to the drivers. They start to beat, beat. So I beg them. They say, if I go town, I do some work until I get that money and paid and live there.
So you had to work for a couple of years to pay?
Yes.
For years?
Yes.
For years. Adam in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Adam, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
My name's Adam, and I'm Nigerian as well. I was calling to address your previous caller that called somehow trying to put culpability of the situation, you know, trying to blame the American and the European government. I'm sorry, where's the African Union in all of this? You know, people don't realize, but some of the wealthiest people on the planet live in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Those people can help. I don't understand why we have to, you know, somehow look to or blame, you know, America. They have their own problems. Europe has its own problems. Africans and the African Union should be called upon to solve African problems. Thank you. I'll take the answer off the air.
Got it, Adam. Nema, what do you say to Adam, Nigerian calling in the U.S., Oklahoma?
I would say to Adam that I see where he's coming from, but when Europe is part of the problem, you know, Ben so eloquently described the way that European governments deal with whatever militia can package themselves effectively enough to claim to be a government. I mean, the international recognition of the Libyan parties is essentially a modesty veil to give Europe someone to discuss migration with. So when you know that you're dealing with parties who are in no way democratically credible, are in no way credible in terms of their actions on the ground, and often are part and parcel of the trafficking problem, then you have a moral culpability. Yes, absolutely, so does the African Union. And the Anti-Illegal Migration Agency head told us that they have a series of phone numbers for pushermen, for smuggling brokers in Nigeria that nobody has acted upon. So absolutely, yes, the African Union has culpability. But Europe itself shouldn't hide behind the modesty veil of, you know, of a hashed together internationally recognized government.
Ben, take it further upstream all the way. I mean, Adam says, what about, you know, wealthy Africans? And it's not as if everybody's helpless in Nigeria. What about the argument, well, that should be dealt with at the source?
Well, it's a completely valid point. Nigeria is the richest country in Africa, and yet it's a place where the percentage, not just the sheer number, but the actual percentage of people living in total poverty is growing. There is an extraordinary problem of inequality in West Africa and across the Sahel, the whole sort of band of through which these migrants and refugees are crossing before they get to the
mm-hmm.
Sahara.
Yep.
This is a site, the Sahel is the site of a convergence of many, many problems, many of which are driving people to leave. There are enormous issues of population explosion, violent extremism, climate change, food insecurity. All of these things are converging at a time when logistic networks are making this movement easier and cheaper than ever before. There is also a kind of uncomfortable historical side to this, which is that they're actually traveling through the same remote villages that made up the ancient caravan route of the Trans-Saharan slave trade. For 1,000 years, over the past thousand years, 9 million black slaves were transported through these places en route to Tripoli, and then they'd be sent to the Arab world and some to Europe. But now, you know, these old slave routes, once again, are completely ungovernable and awash in weapons. And so you have these people who set out voluntarily, then finding themselves being trafficked and traded between owners and forced to work as laborers or prostitutes.
What about Macron? We heard Emmanuel Macron in that tape saying, you know, we have to take police action against the human traffickers network. What about treating this as a policing problem or a criminal problem, Ben?
It is it's an idea that sounds fair and reasonable. The problem is that there have been attempts to do this and they have completely failed. The most sort of complete investigation was carried out by the Palermo Anti-Mafia Division in Sicily. They're famous for having dismantled the mafia. And
what, they went after the slave traders in a similar way, or the smugglers?
Yeah, they went after, they basically tried to use anti-mafia techniques, which were investigating organized criminal networks as if basically the trafficking networks and the slave trading networks are an organized criminal network. So they said, okay, well, if we wiretap everyone, we can try to figure out who's at the top and essentially mm-hmm. decapitate the organization by arresting one of the big guys. And then this can sort of fall apart. But in the end, they arrested the wrong guy. They arrested a random refugee who actually was a milkman who had the same first name as the smuggler, because they're wiretapping all these calls that they can't understand because they're in dozens of different, dozens of languages, none of which the Italians speak. So they're relying on local partners. In this case, they relied on the Sudanese, who were completely corrupt, whose president is wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes and crimes against humanity, and yet is paid hundreds of millions of dollars by the EU to police migration. And so, you know, they're sent the wrong guy. But even so, the actual smuggler they were looking for has gone out of the business. I spoke to him recently. And it has made no effect because, sure, maybe he was one of the leading smugglers in the industry, but this isn't structured as an organized criminal network. There isn't really a chain of command. There's a massive demand for movement, and there are all these logisticians who fill small roles in this mm-hmm. entire web. So arresting some major figures is sort of a nice way for Europe to say that it's done something useful, but it doesn't fix any of the problems. Mm.
Jay in Westland, Michigan. Jay, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom, and thanks for accepting me. Ben, thank you very much. I am originally from English-speaking Cameroon in West Africa. Mm. And to hell with Macron. Macron is part of this problem. And African dictators are part of the problem. For example, African countries still pay colonial taxes to France. Please, let your journalists investigate it. And let me give you an example. Right now, in Cameroon, a prison for 2,000 people harbors 15,000 people in deplorable conditions. By Paul Biya, he's been in power for 35 years. What are these guys going to do in Europe? They have the resources there. But all these resources are controlled by France.
Jay, you're fading out on us, but I think we've got the main gist of it. Raja, let me put it to you, if I may. I mean, the world doesn't want to look at this, doesn't want to see this, doesn't want to see it happening. You know, where do you? You've been in the thick of it, like Ben, like Nema. Where do you turn in your mind for responsibility, for solution, for an answer to what we're seeing?
Well, I think everyone is responsible, and I think, like what they said, the solutions aren't simple or easy, but we can actually start. And I feel like, from a personal perspective, we can start with the countries where these people come from, make these countries better for them, and where they can have better opportunities and safer. And second, there needs to be safe passage, and there needs to be a better system for people to be able to go and have opportunities to do what they want to do, and they shouldn't have to resort to get on a boat and possibly risk losing their life or slavery to be able to go somewhere to just have a job or to get an education or to do what they feel like, live a better life. Mm. So I think it is everyone that needs to get involved.
Nema, do you think the kind of horror that we see in the video, the kind of video that you and Raja brought out, does that slow this down? Do people in Nigeria and elsewhere in West Africa and beyond, do they see this? They must already know that the risks are terrible, but does it slow down the flow?
Well, of course, everyone always thinks that that won't be me, that I'll be the one who makes it to Europe. I'll be the one who realizes my dreams. And I think what has slightly gotten lost in all of this finger pointing, and Raja is right and Ben is right, there are no simple solutions, is that fundamentally this is about people being stripped of their dignity, whether at the most extreme point being dehumanized and sold as slaves, or even being barred entry to Europe, the dignity to have dreams, the dignity to believe. Victory, who you played a little bit of sound from, he wants to be a designer. He's a stylist. You know, he's this incredibly fun 21-year-old who hoped that he would end up in Italy working for Dolce & Gabbana. Mm. And when you say that to people, they sound shocked, as if he doesn't have the right to that dream, as if their expectation is that he's fleeing to get to Europe to clean toilets. Mm-hmm. And I think, I'm from Sudan myself, I think as an African, you often question what the hierarchy is on dreaming. Do those kids in those villages in the back of beyond, do they have to dream small? Is that what we're telling them?
The hierarchy of dreaming. Surely nobody's dreaming of being a slave, Nema.
No, but the ability to delude ourselves is a fundamentally human one, isn't it? It's one we all share.
Wow. Yes, but what an end of the road for those who end up with the gavel coming down, sold for $400 or whatever it may be. It's a powerful video that you and Raja brought out, and we thank you for your courage at CNN International in going in there to bring out this reporting that we can all observe and absorb. Nema El Bagher in London today, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Raja Razek, award-winning producer there at CNN, thank you as well. And Ben Taub with The New Yorker, thank you for all your work and your insights today.
Thank you.
Thank you to you all for that real reporting from the field. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.